Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkwick. Hey, Kirk. Good talking to you again.
Good to hear your voice.
Yeah. Hey, I got a note the other day. There was somebody, they weren't in the Denver area, otherwise I would have called you right away. But they were in Albuquerque. And they said, you know, where do I go to do some environmental testing? And I'm like, Well, outside, if you want to do hot, dry temperatures.
You open the doors.
My wife got a question once a couple of years ago, and she's on a travel form and helps people figure out how to get from here to there and what to see and stuff like that, plan their trips. And she got a question is, where do I go to see the stars? And I looked at her and says, did you tell him to go outside and look up?
Don't try this
at home. Yeah.
Right.
But anyway, these folks were, I mean, it sounded like they didn't have a lab inside and they wanted to do some testing and maybe needed to do some rain or temperature or thermal cycling or whatever. And you and I both have used outside labs over the years, but I think, like you, I much prefer the inside in the company labs, but sometimes you just don't have that much capital. So,
right, and that's where you if the company is going to be a long term producer of many products, and that they've had nothing as far as at least a thermal chamber, whether it's a rapid thermal or not, at least they have some stressing equipment somewhere in their facility, because it's a significant, it's kind of exponential having a chamber inside your house. The benefit is exponential.
And exponential in what way?
What do you mean? In the fact that the potential return on investment and the benefit that you get from being able to do iterations easily with your test equipment, your monitoring equipment, the specifics of maybe you're testing an electrical control system with a mechanical, electromechanical motors and things outside the chamber that you'd like to tie to. You're going to have if you have a chamber in your facility, and most of your engineering design work is done there, as well as assembly, you're going to have access to the critical people, the design engineers, the software engineers, the people that can help you understand, or you can also show when you do find an error, and especially if they've seen it in the field, you'll have them convinced. Like if you go to an elevated temperature or cold temperature and a software bug or a software lockup happens.
Well, it makes it all much quicker to because you got more eyes in the building to go take a look at it. I know I've taken stuff out of the lab and say, walked it upstairs and said, hey, look, this broke.
Right.
Which is really, really close. You can also do that with, nowadays you put them on FaceTime basically and do a live video with them and say, hey, look, you can't smell this, but it really smells bad, like something's burning. And there's a little trail. I did that once. There was a little trail of smoke coming out of the product. And I said,
sure.
You can, there's things, if you have to go outside.
You're forced to go outside. And I would say that's fine for compliance testing. I mean, if you have to demonstrate that your product can operate at plus.
Well, then there's certified labs and you get all this. Yeah.
Right.
You get,
so, right. Yeah.
Those are fine.
Right.
But I agree with you.
But if you're really trying to develop a product, okay, and you're going to be developing multiple products, and there, many of them are electronic controlled electromechanical systems that you're going to have several iterations of your development, you're going to, at each stage, you're going to need different, you may need different personnel. And it's very hard when you're in a lab situation. Maybe you can do the FaceTime or whatever, or Zoom meeting with it. But having those people and having them aware and actually seeing with the hands-on being able to observe in the chain.
I agree that having it in-house is great. Yeah. Let's go to a scenario, and I didn't know what size company this was I was talking to, but let's say you're a startup. You don't have capital to go build a lab. You don't know if you're even going to get your first product launched or not. You're just trying to create a good product. And it's in regulatory stuff, that's a whole different world. I don't deal with that. It just doesn't make much sense to me whatsoever. But let's say they want to say, hey, will this work in hot weather or cold weather? Will it work in thermal cycling? Will it work when it gets rained on? Will it, you know, all these different things.
Right. You might, those are, yeah.
I mean, will it work with different power?
You're not going to buy it.
Different things.
Probably not going to buy us. Yeah.
And so you get all these drop testing, you know, type stuff, you know, depending on your product and how much control you want to do. But let's say you most areas where there is product development, not all areas, and I had no idea if Albuquerque had any of this stuff or not. It turns out they do.
They do.
There's a warehouse full of chambers and all kinds of cool gadgets and stuff. And the idea, though, is that it's not like you walk up to them and say, hey, can you do some testing for me? They're going to look at you with a blank stare. Yeah, that's what we do. But what do you want? How big's your product and all that other stuff. But then, you know, it's not, I've often heard this phrase from somebody within an organization, usually in the development team, we'll just throw it in a chamber. What do you want me to throw it really hard into the back of the chamber? Because they won't like that. Yeah. Do you want to power this thing on? Does that matter? You know? So there's some, whether you do it in-house or out, you still kind of have to figure out, well, what is it you're trying to learn? What is it you're trying to work on and stuff? But let's say you got a decent plan, you got a decent idea what you're looking for, you want to know if it works in these different temperature ranges, for example, and you just want to go see if it works. And you live in Albuquerque, so it's not cold enough, you know, in the middle of the summer. No. So you go to the chamber and they put some nitrogen in it and they... But you still need to know what you're doing. So let's give in that. But it's not something you walk up to the door and say, here's our products, go test it and walk away. I really don't like doing that.
Following a cookbook, compliant.
That's the settings.
You don't want to do that.
I still wouldn't want to do that.
People do that. I know I wouldn't lots that do either, it. But people do that. And they say, you know, my customer requires that I do this test. So can you do this test for me? It's not halt. It's not a development test.
No, it's
they're
just
not trying to make
85C for an hour. And like, okay, whatever.
It's a demonstration test. It's a, you know, it's check the box test. You know,
if you got to go spend that money, I still argue that if you're going to go do anything with your product, you got to learn something. And there's all kinds of reasons people go do this and they just check the box. Well, that's a waste of time. That's a whole different topic.
They usually learn something if they don't pass. Okay.
Well, then they ignore it because it was overstressed. So, you know, there's that. But if you're going to go to an outside lab, usually these labs have an engineer that will help you figure out what exactly are they going to do and what are you going to do. And if it's only a couple of day test, go make sure it's hooked up, make sure it's running, make sure the chambers are running, gather information the way you, whatever, which way you can. If there's a failure, you're on site. If it's intermittent, the lab techs that at these labs, they may or may not notice it. So how are you going to measure it? What are you going to do? But work with the team internally as to what's a good practice? What's the best practice? How do I get the most out of this? What should I learn? You and I, if you're going out to do a halt test, bring your engineers, you know, bring somebody that really knows the product, sit next to the chamber for 3 days.
Depending on where that lab is,
fly them out there. You know as well as I do, you need
expenses.
Well, it's expensive, but if it's something that you want to do to improve the reliability of your product, it's chump change compared to half your product failing in the first week, you know.
Well, that's a guess, unless they have a record where they've had a, then they're really motivated. But I can't see that you're going to convince a company that's had a 3-5% failure rate or something like that on a small, lower cost product. It's not going to be cost effective.
I No, I disagree with that. Full-time, Kirk. Full-time. I wholly disagree with that.
I
insist that my clients get a knowledgeable person, engineer. It doesn't mean it's a quality person or a reliability person, but somebody that knows the design.
Right.
And it really pays off when you get one of those intermittent failures. And I said, if you're not there, I won't know what to look for. You know, and if if I do a data recorder and we get a blip,
right,
you're not there to do the first set of root cause, you know, to figure out, debug this thing, figure it out. You need to be there. And if, especially if we're doing an overstress or we're doing a halt type thing.
Yes.
Now, if it's going to be 85 degrees and we're going to be in it for an, you know, for a week or something like that, for whatever unknown reason. Yeah, it's just running, right? You know, set up your monitoring system.
It's not a known reason. The reason is that this is a required compliance test.
Well, we're not going to do it. I'm not talking about compliance testing.
All right.
But let's say somebody says, we want to, you know, the old-fashioned burn-in, or we know we have to be in this hot environment, maybe under the hood of a car or something like that, for some myriad of time.
And so, a month.
You know, in those kind of things, I'm not going to sit next to the chamber for ask an engineer to sit there. But when it's an exciting test where we're doing step stress or where we're doing lots of different things, then you have to have the engineer there. But if it's just, you know, we're going to put some water on it and hope it doesn't cause a problem, I can tell you whether it failed or not. Those kind of things. But every situation is a little bit different. But I think the basic idea, if you're working in an outside lab, have a plan. What is it you're trying to accomplish? Work with the engineers at the lab and the techs at the lab. What can they do and can't do? And what do they recommend you do to get the most out of your test? And then whenever possible, get as much monitoring, live people and or instrumentation going as much as you can. Get as much information out of that test as you possibly can.
I would agree with that, and I agreed, but I also would caution that it takes a lot of test equipment sometimes. Sometimes that remote lab does have some of the test equipment. They don't know exactly. They certainly probably don't. If your equipment is complex, they're not going to be familiar with its operation.
No.
You may even not have one person that knows how
everything,
you know,
all
the it's very difficult. But this is where I say that, you know, for that kind of testing that you don't do, which is, you know, meets the spec, 85, whatever, that if you're going to do that, to me, that's a remote lab kind of thing and you're a one-time deal. But when you're talking about halt or you're talking about, you know, step stress to failure, you're going to have to do different, you're going to have to do iterations, the timing of those iterations, when those problems can be corrected, spare parts, replacement
parts.
You
might have a whole truck beside your product full of stuff to go down there.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I've been there, done that. Yeah.
it just gets exponentially more difficult when you go to a remote lab than if you invest. Like,
we're not talking about investing. If you have to go to an outside lab, and many people don't have a Holt chamber the first time around. Once they do it and they have a lot of success with it and they go, wow, that's really useful. Then it's easy to get one in. Well easier, I should say, to bring one in.
That would be another aspect.
But the first step is, so I go to outside labs when I don't have the capital and I don't have the time to go through the budgeting process and wait 2 years to get the $150,000 I need for it.
So how do you have a feeling that you're going to find something that they've either seen as a problem in the field or you can make a very strong case that this will be a problem in the field, latent?
You've heard my story a number of times. I had a small handheld device and we knew it was going to be dropped.
About other companies.
This was a company I am working with, and they say, we don't have that vibration table. We don't have that way to apply vibration.
Okay.
And they didn't. And they also didn't have a way to apply dust, like the little cyclone-looking thing that blows Arizona road dust number at it and stuff like that. They didn't have that equipment, but they knew it was going to be part of the environment.
Okay.
Right? So he said, all right, there's a lab down in the Bay Area that I know. I'll go work with them. And it was really weird. I walk in there and they had all these huge floodlights, like big, like the opening of a car dealership, you know, the big, huge floodlights that go up you know, shining right. big beams mm-hmm. in there. They had like mm-hmm. 15 of them in their lobby. Mm-hmm. They had all the windows open. It was just cranking out a bunch of heat. There was a load they were putting on some power supply, and they needed something to pull a lot of watts.
I was like, okay.
Why didn't you put them outside? Our cables weren't long enough. That mm-hmm. lobby was so bright. It was amazing. But anyway, so right. I walk in and we get this thing on the vibration table and it's powered on and it's, you know, it's got its own batteries and stuff. And then all of a sudden the lights went out mm-hmm. on the thing. And it was like, all right, what's going on? And we opened the chamber and you could smell the burning of phenolics being burnt. Mm-hmm. And the wire coming out of the battery case was mm-hmm. routed to a spot on the circuit board, but it was mm-hmm. not a direct line. It had to make okay. a corner. And that okay. corner rubbed through the top of the circuit board into the opposite polarity. Of course, it was the opposite polarity
right.
trace right under it. So it went to a dead mm-hmm. short. Mm-hmm. And that's the one where I, you know, get on the phone and say, hey, you want to see a video of this?
You know, this was a product they'd already shipped or were going to ship.
Oh, they were going to, it was probably a month or 2 months away from going okay. to starting the manufacturing lines. And,
right.
And I said, you know, this might be a problem.
And, right.
You know, we were just at the lowest vibration. We were just getting started.
Right.
And it fried. And,
right.
You know, high consequence, you know, didn't smell good at all. Took out the product completely, mm-hmm. you know, and stuff yeah, like that. Yeah. But if we would have just said, oh, we don't have a vibration table, it'll be all right. We'll just kind of jiggle it around in our hands a little bit and hope we'll find out. That's when you go to the lab. They got the equipment. You can get it done. Yeah, it costs $1,000 for the day to do that, you know, but they learn so much. On the other hand, if the test would have revealed nothing, we went up to a huge amount of vibration and nothing failed, then you know they're really robust. No trouble with vibration for the way we applied it. But the idea was is that...
Well, Fred, let's look at the alternative.
Yeah.
That you did go to the lab. They yeah. did take it to shake it, and you had two samples, okay? Yeah. Maybe you had three. You did all of them. They got to, you know, 60 GRMS or some incredibly powerful level for 30 minutes. Nothing broke.
Yeah, cool.
Okay.
This product is robust. Let's go.
Okay. And so, yeah. So they said, well, we spent $1,000 for what?
So now you know you have margin.
$3,000 probably by the time you get to the end of it for yeah, one
but,
day.
But that's lab. Cheap compared to not knowing. So I think there's a...
We never thought it was going to fail at, you know, whatever.
Well,
so,
they didn't know. No, it
well,
wasn't
they didn't
they
know,
didn't.
But now they say,
we
okay,
know.
We spent $3,000 and we know it's pretty mechanically robust. But that doesn't guarantee the future ones if no. somebody doesn't plug in a connector or somebody does, you know,
oh, yeah.
short wire
oh, yeah.
around, does
I agree.
Strain relief.
I totally agree. It's not perfect.
Okay, okay.
But you have a difference between... We know that this is going to get, you know, it was a handheld product. And one of the things in the gaming system that it was doing is that it would be in your hand when you clapped your hands and it would sense that,
right.
that part of it. So it was going to be clapped. And
right.
so he said, do we want to have, you know, a couple of your techs stand around all day and
right.
clapping various ways to see if
no.
it and throw it around? Or should we spend, you know, a half a day in a lab and put it on a vibration table?
Right. And you could probably put, with the size of it, you could probably put several samples on the
oh,
vibration.
Yeah, yeah
it'll and then, okay.
suitcase
so
full
the,
of
let's
things.
Say this is very, again, just like we talk about HALT, it's very product specific.
Oh, yeah.
And
always
it's probably
is.
Issue specific. But I'm talking about if I want to get a company to start on a program of using stress to develop their products and find issues. Unless they have a high failure product, okay, that I can go to the lab and say, look, there's 30% of them. If I take 10, there's a good chance I'll show that problem in one of them because I know what the, you know, failure mode is. I can kind of guess what maybe the driving force or driving stress might be, or they have a history of field returns.
Yeah. In all of those cases, you don't even need testing. Just go fix it. Go make it more robust. You know, what do you need to prove it for? You know, go fix it.
Most difficult, of course, as you mentioned, are intermittents.
Yeah. yeah.
Where it comes back, you know, and that's, you know, we see that all the time that people report that their warranty returns 30% or well, I don't have any problem.
Yeah, no, it's just fine. And then you put it under a halt or a halt style or a little bit of stress and it shows up. Right. Yeah. Right. We've talked about that a bunch. Right. But anyway, what I like, and we didn't even get into going to failure analysis labs because the capital goes up through the roof of what it costs to do that.
But I think that requires very specialized equipment.
And skills to use it too.
Skills, SEMs, decapsulation, using the grinders to
cross-sectioning, potting and cross-sectioning, the x-rays, all kinds of cool stuff.
Yeah, it's really helpful that that's independent from the component manufacturer because the component manufacturer himself probably not disclose, especially if it's an error. You know, they might just EOS or something and say it's electrical overstress.
They have five standard answers. Yeah,
right.
but when it's just a thermal chamber. Let's say you're starting a product and you don't have the internal capital to have thermal chambers or vibration tables or dust extra, you know, things. I worked with one group the once and they said, well, our product creates a lot of heat. Let's just put it in this closet over here and close the door. And internally it got up to about 60°C just by itself doing this stuff. And they learned a lot from that. They found all kinds of issues with that. And that was, you know, you can do half steps. You can get creative dependent on your product and everything else.
Sure.
But the idea is that product testing is expensive, internal or external. There's so many advantages to do it internal to your company. Yet you might face that hurdle that it's a 6-month wait to get the chamber. And, you know, it costs
a bunch.
It takes time and it takes energy and you got to justify it.
And they said, go away. We're going to take 3 months to get the chamber and set up the facility. Then we'll call you back. And they did.
Yeah.
And
no, that's great. But the idea is that if you don't have 3 months, and you need to go work with an outside lab. There are great labs and there's other labs that are just, they have a bunch of chambers and a bunch of equipment and they say, hey, you know, you can, it's like renting a storage unit. Yep. You go rent chamber number 6, have a good time. Don't break it. We'll charge you by the day.
And then I would agree, Fred, there's certain things that I would always probably go outside to do. One would be a dust chamber. Those are specialized.
Yep.
It's not a common halt type test, although you could make it a halt test, or salt spray, or
salt spray because it'll get everything else in your lab corroded if you have a salt spray machine in the lab.
Right, right, right. And those are kind of, you know, those to me aren't specific application and need for. It's not done to all it's generally as what you can find from thermal and vibration.
Yeah, those things
Voltage
great.
Margining don't require a chamber sometimes.
No.
There are other things, frequency margining, if you know how to do that in a digital system, that'd be great. You know, those are helpful. So all those things, it just depends on the product. And again, if it's a long-term, if you have the capital, if you're going to make it a long-term change in your development, of your product and reliability to develop your product, you need to make you. And that's what I've done with my most successful was the first one was convince management they need to have this equipment.
Yep.
That was looking at their own failures and showing that most of those could have been found or precipitated early on through a HASS or another process.
And if you have the chambers yourself, there's no waiting you have to, no contracting, no waiting to get on their schedule. Right. It's travel, everything else. You just go downstairs and run the test. And
the engineers that have found success with it want to do their little subsystem maybe. They want to run a little test on it as they build it up.
Yeah.
And so they have that.
Feedback's way earlier then.
Right. You know? Right. So they can make small, changes quickly to the design before they get it to a full assembly.
So do we need to change the title of this as don't use outside labs?
No. I think we have, and I've told you, dust chamber, salt spray, might be ultraviolet radiation exposure. You know, there's very many tests that are application specific that you really can't justify, but to me, thermal and vibration are two of the fundamental stresses in nature that almost every product will be subjected to. They've got to be transported at least some point. They're going to be, if they're worldwide distribution, they're going to have a lot of different thermal environments. So, that's that's where I say those are the most fundamental, the value of the chamber. The value of a salt spray chamber, if you're making marine equipment,
yeah, it'd be useful.
Sure, you got to have it. Or underwater pressure chambers, like if you do the hyperbaric, autoclave, something like that, where you're trying to sterilize medical equipment. Those are, that's important for somebody who's making, like I talked to one company who made the gastric bypass staplers, that would go in. And they had to subject these things to an autoclave. And I said, I said, it's not the temperature that's your problem, apparently, because your circuit boards go up way past that. I said, it's the pressure and moisture you're forcing into that. That's probably the problem. But they kind of they combined the whole, they were confusing themselves by not doing a thermal stress and then a humidity stress separately to see that, no, thermal
where
wasn't
the issue was,
the issue wasn't thermal. The issue was moisture intrusion probably into the package or FR4 material or whatever the boards they had. So,
anyway, there's lots of reasons. There's outside labs exist, and they are a viable business for folks. It's really contingent on, you need to know what you're doing and talk to the right people and get a good plan in place. Get as much information as you can. If you need to bring your engineering team or some representatives to help you get through the troubleshooting and everything else, get them there.
Right.
It makes it so that you do that 2-3 times and you've learned stuff, you find out stuff, you determine, and then the manager says, why don't we just do that in house? We do that 3 times, it pays for a chamber. Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's what we told you 3 months ago. Come on.
Right. Right. And so, but the opposite is you go to outside lab, you take a product that's pretty robust, and nothing happens, and they'll say, we don't see anything that we need, have any benefit for this. So we're not going to invest $130,000 in a chamber here or, any kind of other environmental stress equipment.
Yeah, and then next generation, they push it a little too far and all their products fail. I've seen that too. They say, we've never learned anything from these tests. So we ignore them now. We don't even bother doing them.
Right, exactly.
Right, cool. You just changed 90% of your product and you made it out of tinfoil instead of steel. You might have a problem, guys. And they did.
Yeah, it'll show up eventually when it's too late. Yeah. And that's the long-term nature of reliability.
Yeah, but the folks that listen to this podcast know that you got to do due diligence. You got to take care of stuff. Figure out where the risks are and go learn stuff there. So, but anyway, if you're listening to this, you think Kirk and I are crazy, which we are most of the time. Let us know. Maybe we've been next to a chamber too long, or maybe inside one of those chambers too long. But let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can find a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Kirk and I and the other hosts are available through LinkedIn and our about pages. And so this question out of this team out of Albuquerque is like, you need to, think about it. What do you need in-house? What do you need outside? And have a plan. Either way, you got to figure out what you're doing.
You got to figure out what you're doing, but it's kind of like, what plans and war.
They change as soon as you start.
Our plans in a fight it kind of falls apart the first punch,
Yeah, it always does. Yeah. But, it still doesn't mean you
falls
can't.
Falls apart the first failure.
Well, then you learn something. Then you're off and running. You learn something.
So, you start to learn something, yes, for
That's
sure.
Right. All right. Well, thanks, Kirk. So
okay, Fred.
I'll keep the title as it is. We'll keep it.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.